You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky. Brands are spending more on e-commerce advertising due to projected rising online sales. If you're in charge of hiring for your business, these pivots have made your job even more challenging, especially if you have to hire for brand new roles. Thankfully, there's one place you can always count on to make hiring faster and easier, ZipRecruiter.com/murder. When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, it gets sent out to over 100 top job boards with one click. Then, ZipRecruiter's powerful technology finds people with the right skills and experience for your job and actively invites these people to apply. It's no wonder that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See for yourself. Right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/MURDER. Let ZipRecruiter take finding quality, qualified candidates off your plate so you can focus on growing your business. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Good evening. On a warm night in September 1985, teenagers Kimberly Dowell and Ethan Dixon were brutally murdered in Westside Park in Muncie, Indiana. Their killer has never been charged. Early on, police focused on a family member of one of the teens as a primary suspect. The investigation even ruled out fantastic scenarios, including a theory that the perpetrator was a Dungeons and Dragons devotee. The case grew cold. Only decades later did a dogged police investigator narrow the scope to a suspect whose name has never been publicly revealed until now. Keith Roysden and Douglas Walker, authors of Wicked Muncie and Muncie Murder and Mayhem, have followed the investigation into the Westside Park murders for decades, and for the first time, report the complete and untold story. The book that we're profiling this evening is The Westside Park Murders, Muncie's Most Notorious Cold Case, with my special guest journalist and author, Keith Roysden. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Keith Roysden.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Thank you so much. Let's start with how you came to be involved with this, and also, we mentioned your co-author, Douglas Walker. Give us your background that led to this as well, your professional background, and also your connection to this area of Muncie, Indiana.
Muncie is about 45 minutes, 50 minutes northeast of Indianapolis, and it has a long history as a blue-collar town, but one that also has this strange kind of cultural artifact because of a sociological study from the 1920s. And it's been mentioned in many pop culture venues like Close Encounters of the Third Kind. The opening scenes of the movie were set in Muncie. So Muncie's always been this kind of strange microcosm of the nation, but also it is this hotbed over the decades of crime, corruption, fairly unsavory elements. So as newspaper reporters, and Doug is still an active newspaper reporter for the Star Press newspaper here in Muncie, I took a buyout a couple of years ago before we started work on the Westside Park Murders book. So as newspaper reporters, we had come into contact many times with some pretty interesting stories. The Westside Park murders occurred in, as you said, September 1985, and I believe the first article that we, Doug and I, wrote about the murders was in 1997. And at right. that time, we kind of recapped the case and had the first really public statements from Kimberly's stepfather, who had lived under this cloud of suspicion for 12 years. And after 1997, we continued to write when there would be a significant development or a significant anniversary. And in 2010, we kind of informally launched a series that we did called Cold Case Muncie, which was about, I had to count them up the other day because I wasn't sure how many had appeared. It was about more than 34 unsolved murders here in right. Muncie in Delaware County. And it seemed natural to start with the Westside Park case because it was the one that everyone remembers. I personally liked giving some publicity to ones where the victims had been totally forgotten over the decades. There was right. nothing remotely resembling an active investigation, not even a cold case, really. They were totally forgotten. But Westside Park was not forgotten by people. It had left a real, I don't know if scar is the right word, but it definitely left a mark on the community because of the nature of the crime and how totally mystifying the case was to many people. So in 2010, we did a fairly extensive 25th anniversary story, and that started the ball rolling again in that within a couple of years, the Muncie Police Department had assigned a promising younger investigator to look at their extensive files on the case, boxes and boxes in a room in Muncie City Hall. And all along, we kind of knew that we would be coming back to the case at some point. Kimberly's father, who is a physician locally, had really helped us greatly with the story in 2010 and had basically, the man has the most, I guess, optimistic and realistic attitude I think a parent could ever have, in the sense that he thought maybe some good would come from this horrible event at some point in the future, if nothing else, kind of bringing the community together. And right. so he had cooperated with the 2010 case. In 2018, when our second true crime book was out, Dr. Dowell was the first person in line at a book signing for it at Minnetrista wow. Cultural Center here in Muncie. And Doug and I had kind of looked at each other, and then we broached the subject with the doctor and said, you know, what would you think if we did, because obviously we'd written regular articles for the newspaper. We asked, what would you think if we did a full-fledged treatment of this, possibly as a book-length treatment of it? And Dr. Dowell just seemed quite pleased with the idea. He really liked the possibility that his daughter's murder and Ethan's murder would continue to get some attention. And now we were approaching the 35th anniversary, still a couple of years away from it. But I think he knew that as everyone was aging and memories were fading, there was the possibility that this was an opportunity for a big splash to get the word out, to get the facts as they're known out. So he was totally cooperative, very encouraging, sat down with Doug for interviews, loaned us family photos, things like that.
Let's get to this fateful evening, September 28th, 1985. And there's a police officer, a patrolman from the Muncie Police Department, Patrolman Terry Winters. He's a 34-year-old guy, and so he is at Westside Park. Tell us what this officer is doing outside Westside Park or in Westside Park that evening, September 28th.
Well, strangely, over the years, there was this mistaken assumption that he just happened to be in the park. But the truth was, he was still on duty. A lot of people mistakenly believed that he had been off duty, and they found it suspicious that at almost midnight on this evening that he would be there in the park. And but he was on duty, and one of his duties was to, as midnight approached, kind of encourage people to get out of the park, to drive off and go home. And he also had a police dog, a canine officer, and that gave him an opportunity to let the canine officer run a little bit in the park. So Officer Winters saw a car sitting on a, and Westside Park is not very wide. I mean, you can see from this, the nearest street, White River Boulevard, you can see clear to the White River on the other side of it. It's not extremely long, but it's very kind of a deep park and very long and linear with a lot of trees. And he saw there was a car parked on a little lane closer to the river side of the park. So he thought, okay, I need to tell these people they're probably parked there for the reasons you might assume that, that people were parked in a park at almost midnight. I need to tell these people to move along. And he walked up with his flashlight and shone it in the car and was, I'll never forget him telling us this. He was so startled by what he saw, he turned the light off for a moment. And then he turned it back on. Wow. And, of course, there are these two young people in the car, and each one has been shot. And so he immediately, of course, radioed that in very quickly. A lot of Muncie police personnel are there, and they start doing what is obviously the standard police procedure of stationing people at the entrances to the park and not allowing people to get into the park. Theoretically not allowing people to leave the park, and also keeping a record of all the personnel who are coming and going, the authorized personnel. And very quickly, considering how late it was, the newspaper, which was one of two at the time, the Muncie Star, had a reporter there, and they were able to do a story for the next day's paper that did not have names of the victims, but it did have a photograph. So and really, when you consider how much more mobilization of forces it took to cover a story like that in a brief period of time 35 years ago compared to now, when I could stand there with my iPhone and take pictures and post them to online stories and things like that. I mean, it's remarkable that they got a 12-paragraph story with a photo in that next morning's paper. But the investigation continued through that night, and police were incredibly frustrated by how really little evidence there was, because they initially believed, and it's probably the case, that the killer stood outside the car, pointed his or her gun, fired into the car, and didn't really have any contact in the manner of touching the victims or anything like that. So word spread very quickly, and by the next day, it was just spreading like wildfire through the entire city.
Tell us about the parents of Ethan. How old is he? And Kimberly, tell us about their parents. You mentioned Anthony, Kimberly's physician father, but tell us about the parents of these couple.
Dr. Dowell was a physician at Ball Memorial Hospital here in Muncie, and he and his wife had separated by that point. He was living in Indianapolis, I believe, and so that's where he was when he got the word. Mm-hmm. Ethan's parents, the family owns a local factory. So both very responsible, well-known members of the community, figures that a lot of people know. And after Kimberly's parents separated and divorced, her mom had remarried And her stepfather, Donald Vogel Gesang, was an official in the athletic department at Ball State University here in Muncie. And so really, these were, as in a way, kind of high-profile families as you could possibly imagine, which, as we note when we quote people in the book, you know, people would say, this kind of thing just doesn't happen to it doesn't happen in our community. What they really mean is it doesn't happen to people like us, because, of course, every community, especially Muncie, has people who are killed and horrible crimes, and usually it's considered a thing that happens to someone else. In this case, it happened to people who are well-known and young people who are well-liked. Ethan was 16 years old. Kimberly was 15 years old. And they had gone to, just like a week before, the Northside High School football team had opened its fall football season. And they had gone to that, and I believe that they were both part of some kind of homecoming court type activities that first week. And then a week later, on a Saturday night, they were there in the park. And of course, you know, Muncie, like any city in the Midwest, is, especially in 1985, but even today, I think young people would say, you know, there are only a limited number of things that you can do. And you could go to a movie, you could go to a concert, maybe a concert in Indianapolis if you were old enough, or you could find a quiet place to sit and talk and you know, maybe you bought a pizza or something like that. So it was immediately one of those situations where people were wondering, okay, why were they there? What were they doing there? And a great deal of speculation considering two elements that were in Ethan's Volkswagen Rabbit hatchback with them. One was a switchblade type knife that was on the dashboard, and one was a gun holster that was partially under Ethan's leg, on between his leg and the seat of the car. And going on 35 years later, that holster and the DNA evidence that might have been part of that would continue to be an element of the case. But of course, like everything else, when you don't really have, and police did not, when they don't have a tremendous amount of facts, they don't, when they don't have answers, a lot of speculation starts, not only about what might be possible legitimate avenues of their investigation, but also of things that rapidly turned into dead ends.
Now, police call for, make a plea for people to come forward that are witnesses, and very interestingly, another marshal from a nearby town comes forward, along with other witnesses, to say that they saw something in the park that night. And you might have mentioned that there was about a dozen cars that were discerned to have been in that park that night around that 11 p.m. And so police asked for people to come forward. Tell us first about this nearby town marshal that said he had something that he actually witnessed in the park that night.
Well, it sounds like kind of a cliche in that there is somebody who might be a witness to the crime, but because they were in a place where they probably shouldn't have been, along with someone they shouldn't have been with, there's always this element of reluctance. And I will mention that it's been an education to me. Even though I worked at the newspaper at the time, I didn't cover the initial case, but it's been an education to me to see what is written in articles and what is not written in articles. I mean, I've always known that as I chose what to put in my coverage of cases or of meetings, for that matter, public meetings, government meetings, elections. But there's not a lot of detail about some of the initial witnesses, suspects, and leads that police pursued in 1985 and the months that followed. So a lot of this came from interviews that we did in 2019, including with Marvin Campbell, who was the deputy chief of police at the time, and who is still has almost unshakable beliefs in the case and the way that he believes it played out. But one of the things that came out of these 2019 interviews with Marvin is that there was a deputy from one of the towns in the area here who was there that night. And this had not been revealed at all in the initial stories, but he came forward in the days following the crime and came to Muncie Police and said, okay, well, he didn't say it this way, I'm sure, but the good news is I might have seen something to help your investigation. The bad news is I was there with a woman and we probably shouldn't have been there. And so now, you know, I've got some exposure and she's got some exposure if this gets out. But he had provided Marvin Campbell with this element of, I saw this vehicle and I saw this man behind the wheel who had kind of stared at me and maybe in kind of an effort to intimidate me and get me to leave. I saw him go ahead and when that didn't work, when he didn't intimidate this deputy marshal, the car pulled away and went in the general vicinity of where the shooting happened just a few moments later. But that was corroborated by a couple of other people who were in the park that night. And that, yes, we saw a vehicle that looked vaguely like this vehicle. So police really started to focus very narrowly, to some extent. They certainly fielded hundreds of calls. I think it even got to the point that they did local implementation of the Crime Stoppers tip line in the wake of this. Maybe right. Not just for this case, but the idea that, you know, we're overwhelmed almost with calls. People think, you know, everybody they see at the grocery store matches, you know, the characteristics of a suspect. So The deputy's comments and subsequent comments from other people kind of sparked this narrowing of the focus of the initial investigators to Donald Vogelgesang, Kimberly's stepfather, the university athletic official.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. You talked about Deputy Chief of Police Marvin Campbell looking at Donald Vogelgesang as a really good suspect. Mm-hmm. Other than the typical reason that you would look at family first, what in his mind was the reason why, in his mind, Donald was a suspect?
I think that very quickly they began to look at vehicles, in particular vehicles that were there that night that belonged to Mr. Vogelgesang, and later, as the focus kind of widened, that belonged to other people too. So when, you know, it's one of those things that even now, certainly, I think, you know, if I was a witness to a crime, I'm not really sure that I would be able to say later, oh, that was a dark blue 1983 Monte Carlo or something like that, you know, but apparently right. People who were more capable of that were beginning to identify vehicles. And I can't tell you for certain exactly why Marvin Campbell linked those two. But he became pretty convinced that a car owned by Mr. Vogelgesang came close enough to the general description of a car that was in the park that night that it kind of solidified it for him. Another element of this is that Mr. Vogelgesang came to the park that night. He was stopped by a police officer at one of the entrances, and he said, "I'm here because I'm looking for my stepdaughter. Her mom is really concerned. You know, she was supposed to be home by 11, I think it was, and we haven't heard from her." And I'm not sure how much they kind of broke the news to him right there on the spot, or how much he was able to kind of infer from what they weren't saying. But I've been at crime scenes on a number of occasions when family showed up, and it's this very tense, potentially very emotional moment. And sometimes, you know, I don't know if it's that whole, you know, criminal always returns to the scene of the crime type cliche, or whether as the days went on, the combination of him coming to the scene that night, looking for her, and these any similarity in vehicles and things just kind of started the gears going for Marvin Campbell and some of the investigators. That might be the case, but certainly those two things, I mean, you hate to say that he wouldn't have had this kind of hanging over his head all these years if he hadn't shown up at the park, but he did, and I think that kind of maybe furthered that suspicion a little bit in Marvin Campbell's mind.
Tell us about the composite drawing. Where did they get this witness for this rendition? And in terms of Campbell, did it lead him to further be convinced that Donald Vogelgesang was a good suspect?
You know, the composite drawing doesn't look anything like Don Vogelgesang. And I think right from the beginning, there was that kind of branching of beliefs between these two theories. And probably there were other theories too, but they eventually started falling away. But you had this impression that her stepfather was there and they had a similar vehicle, and you know, maybe the deputy marshal, town marshal who was there knew something or suspected something later based on having seen the vehicle, having a kind of the stare down with a guy. And then you had this composite drawing which came out within a week or so that plainly did not look like a middle-aged university athletic department official. It looked much more like a young person, you know, early 20s, mid-20s, much more, frankly, the age and kind of demographic for somebody to be in the park, whether it was, you know, for, you know, whatever reason. I mean, I enjoy the solitude. I eat my pizza there. I'm there for some illicit purpose, all those things. So those two things didn't really match up, but I think they continue still kind of parallel. And frankly, the suspicion about her stepfather probably was dominant because, like I said about when there are a lack of facts in a case, the public filling that void with rumors and suggestions and things like that. Probably because that was the I say this air quotes, neater theory.
Certainly. Kimberly Dowell's mom is Nancy Vogelgesang. You write that she was a staunch supporter of her husband. They had asked her about her husband's whereabouts. So was, in terms of the police, or at least what you write, was it a seemingly solid alibi for Donald that night?
I certainly think that it was. Again, this plays into those cliches of, well, of course, the loyal wife defends the husband. And whether that's, it is a cliche. And whether that's relevant at all to this, I don't know that anybody could possibly know. But as you're eliminating possibilities, always keeping some in the back of your mind, and always obviously keeping notes in your files and things like that, almost certainly that would, lean toward ruling him out on the part of some investigators, but plainly it never did. One of the more illuminating interviews that we did, of course, in 2019 for the book, was with Marvin Campbell, who still believes that the stepfather had some involvement. I mean, it's fascinating to see how many people, when we see comments about this case on social media, they have their own theories. They often include him. They often include a police officer, sometimes Terry Winters. It's the persistence of these theories in light of, this person saying, no, that couldn't have happened, or Nancy Vogel saying he's not guilty. I sent him looking for her. I don't have any doubts about his involvement. Those things are very compelling and certainly help drive a lot of investigations, yet they persist in the minds of the public.
Let's talk about Nancy Vogel-Gesang still mourning her daughter. This is 2 years later, Christmas Eve, 1987, and she's attending a candlelight service at her church. What happens at the church?
Well, this was one of those things that adds a horrible twist to this case, in that Mrs. Vogel-Gesang, who had gone through so much, I mean, no one could ever possibly imagine how horrible it would be to lose your child, especially in a manner like this. And she became ill that night at the Christmas service and passed away. And, certainly the family was well known in Muncie, but I think the thing that drove the newspaper to do a relatively short, but still nevertheless a short story on page one the next day, was that she had this tragic event in her life only 2 years before. And of course, other things like tragedies become magnified when it's around Christmas time or the Christmas season or something like that. But she passed away at that Christmas service. And, if you're of the kind to, and modern day investigators certainly are, if you're the kind to believe that Don Vogel-Gesang was just a tragic figure in this, wrongly accused, lost his stepdaughter, and then 2 years later loses his wife.
What do police make of Kimberly Dowell? I didn't mention this, but you write that Nancy got a call, a phone call, not long after Kim was killed. And what does this killer have to say? What does he impart to the grieving Nancy Vogel-Gesang?
Well, the horrible thing about this is that, and I have to say, it's the kind of thing that now you would think somebody would say on social media. But Nancy got this call that said, in effect, you know, your daughter was just an innocent bystander. The boy she was there with was the target, and the comment was he got what he deserved, which there's never been any proof that that was the case. But for Nancy to hear that, this random phone call comes to their, I pictured, you know, a phone on the wall of their kitchen or something like that. And for Nancy to pick up the phone and hear this voice saying, you know, well, it's kind of too bad that your daughter died. But she was, you know, she was just a casualty of what happened to Ethan. Just as cruel and heartless a thing as anybody could possibly say.
Let's talk about James Jimmy Swingley. You write that he had left Muncie for Florida shortly after the murder, and some people had said that he'd left the day after. And you talk about when he returned in August 86. Talk about James Jimmy Swingley and his departure and his return in August 86.
Well, there are a lot of, I think, perfectly reasonable, some greater known and some greater unknown, suspects and theories in this case. As more modern-day investigators looked at this case, they started piecing things together about Jimmy Swingley. And one of the things that they noted is that from almost the beginning, he had been cited as someone who had told people that he had been in the park that night. He even told, and again, this is things that are relayed to police. So it's, you know, first or second hand in many ways. He had relayed to people that he had been with somebody who had shot the two teenagers. Mm-hmm. He had relayed to somebody that he shot the two teenagers, that he was there for some kind of a drug deal, which fueled the idea that many people have that Ethan and Kimberly were in the wrong place at the wrong time, that somebody thought that they saw something, and maybe they did and maybe they did not. Right. Swingley had has had a pretty fascinating history of tragedy in his family and some criminal activity on his part leading up to this time. So he was certainly on the radar of police at that time. And at some point after this, he was even, and Muncie police, like a lot of police departments, relied on a lot of techniques at the time that maybe are not as heavily relied on today.
That's
but
right.
At some point he was given what is popularly kind of termed a lie detector test, and had produced fairly damning responses to a couple of questions about the park, if he knew what happened in the park, if he had anything to do with the park that night. So he was really on the radar of police over the years. And then in 1996, I believe it was, he had his own more immediate for him, more so than just being questioned about West Side Park. He had his own more immediate set of legal circumstances. And I'll tell you about that if you'd like, but it kind of took him off the chessboard as far as active investigations for a long time. And really only in the past 10 years have people returned to him. And when I say people, I mean police investigators. Only in the most recent few years have people kind of returned to him as a possible focus. One thing and Douglas Walker and I had written a couple of articles in the 2010s in which police said, you know, we have a much harder lock on a suspect here. We believe we know who did it. We believe there's a person of interest, but they kind of didn't want to get too detailed about it, but we got indications that the person was in prison, which certainly also kind of tamps down some of the urgency of moving forward on a case. But he was increasingly a person of interest for Muncie police, particularly one investigator.
What were the crimes that he was incarcerated for, and what were the types of crimes that he was known for and had a record for?
You know, Muncie is a wonderful community with a lot of really great, caring people. And Muncie is a community with a lot of kind of strange crime and criminal element, probably like any community, really. Certainly, if you kind of measure it by over the course of decades. But Jimmy Swingley had been charged for a period of time with racketeering in a case that involved a number of men who were committing burglaries, including business burglaries, in Indiana and Ohio. We're about one county over from the Ohio state line here. And so certainly he, like I said earlier, he was on people's radar before this. The thing that really, I guess, kind of cemented his legal standing was in, I'm looking at the date here, it was a murder that was just totally unrelated, of course, to Westside Park. Muncie has had, at various times, much greater level of homicide activity. And certainly in sometimes the 1980s and 1990s, it was pretty high. And in November 1996, a 32-year-old man named Brian Insko had been found in his apartment in Muncie, and he was nearly decapitated. And apparently, there had been disputes kind of ongoing between Insko and his roommate as far as rent. And James Swingley was a friend of one of the roommates. Swingley didn't really have any, what I guess you would call in court, any kind of standing in this dispute. It wasn't like the money was going to go to him or anything. But he apparently took offense on behalf of his friend who was owed rent money. So while there was certainly some activity from more than one person that greatly harmed Brian Insko that night in November 1996, prosecutors at the time really came to focus on Jimmy Swingley as the person who had, after the roommate had beaten Insko with a shovel and then maybe did further injuries, serious injuries to him, they came to focus on Swingley cutting Brian Insko's throat. So much so that within the course of 2 years, because it took a while, obviously, for charges to be filed in a case where there was probably more than one person involved in a dispute that led to a fatality, over the course of 2 years, they filed a murder charge against Swingley. And that resulted in April 1999, Stephen Caldemeyer, who was the judge of circuit court at that time, sentencing Swingley to 65 years in prison after he was found guilty.
Yes. Introduce a important character, an investigator, Nathan Sloan. Tell us about Nathan Sloan and how, when does he come into the picture and as a result of what?
Well, as is probably the case in a lot of communities with a lot of police departments, cold cases that are particularly still high profile for the police department and for the public, those get second looks a number of times. Sometimes stories and TV shows make you think all of these go into a dusty file cabinet and they're never brought up again. And certainly that does happen with some, that so much time has passed, there's very little hope of someone coming forward. With the Westside Park case, over the years, Muncie Police had said, here's a really good, young, promising investigator. Let's let him go through all these files and see if they see anything that previous investigators have missed, especially something that might have been missed at the time of the original investigation. So Nate Sloan was, in the early 2010s, was that investigator. After our story appeared on the 25th anniversary in 2010, apparently people started calling. And one of the things we always tried to do with all of our cold case stories was put a point of contact in the story for whatever police department was working on the case, so that if someone knew something, they could call this number and ask for this particular detective. But after our 2010 story appeared, people started calling the Muncie Police Department. And the chief at the time said, we're going to, give these calls to Nate Sloan, and we're going to let him look through these boxes and see what develops. So in about 2011, but I know for a fact 2012, Nate Sloan started really cultivating tips. He would have members of the public calling and telling unlikely stories, likely stories, and he would, pour over old police files, and I think he made some joke about how he locked himself in a room with all the files in the case for a couple of weeks, and sometimes he would have police officers, other officers who would come to him and say, this didn't get a lot of attention back at the time, but maybe you ought to consider looking at this. So after our 2010 story and people knew that the department was actively looking at it again, I don't think that 2010 story even mentioned Sloan by name. But within a couple of years, he was really the person that all that information got channeled to. And we detail in the book a lot of the really, truly fascinating elements of this investigation that he worked through. Not just having to do with Jimmy Swingley, but having to do with one of the most fascinating parts of this whole thing was been possible links to some killings in Concordia, Kansas, in which a couple of young people, a little older than Dixon and Dowell, were killed out there in the early 80s. And a man who appeared in Westside Park here two nights after the killing, that people then ultimately were able to, decades later, were able to place him in Kansas at the time of those killings in Kansas. Not necessarily at the same spot, but certainly in Kansas. So Sloan started working all these leads and new ones kept coming in, and he was very dedicated to it. At the same time, he and other officers are doing a number of investigations all the time. They've always got cases open on their desks. And he and others started working these leads that had not been fully explored in the past. They started doing new interviews. And really all through the 2010s, they regularly met to talk with people and ask them, what do you know about this case? And sometimes they would say, what do you know about this person or that person? And sometimes they would be, I don't know if surprised is the right word, but they would be surprised to go talk to someone. And almost out of the blue, that person would say, Oh, yeah, you're asking me about Jimmy Swingley, right? And it was kind of startling to them to find how very much in the undercurrent of the community there was people who thought, no, it's not the stepfather. No, it's not the canine officer who was there on the scene. No, it's not, this person or that person or some random, drifter you never heard of. It's this person who is repeatedly, again, reportedly told people that he has some involvement. He did it himself. He was there when somebody else did it. He had left the community right after that. And it just kind of gelled as Nate Sloan was looking at this and talking to people.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages. You talked about Nate Sloan doing his due diligence and trying to eliminate everyone and not just focusing on James Swingley, but investigating and re-interviewing and interviewing new people. He even spoke to, I believe, Swingley's wife, ex-wife, spoke to the mother, I believe, as well. So,
right.
But there is an opportunity, he believes, to be able to go to Wabash Correctional Center and actually speak to James Swingley. What happens when he does that? What year is that, and what is the result of that interview?
Well, it's interesting because he and another officer went there twice. They went, I believe, in 2012. And, certainly this is probably not an unknown occurrence, but when they got there, Jimmy Swingley was unwilling to talk to them. F off, basically. He told them, I don't want anything to, I don't want to talk to you people, go away. And of course, in the instance like that, you do. I mean, when you're just going there kind of hoping that somebody over the course of 20 years has maybe gotten remorseful, or maybe they legitimately have someone else who they can point to and say, okay, yeah, I was there. That element of the story is true. I was there, but it was this guy who did it. So when they went in 2012 and Jimmy Swingley basically told him to beat it, Sloan and the other investigators who would kind of work with him on and off over the years, they kind of bided their time. They kind of waited to see what would happen next. And by 2018, Sloan felt like he had, and I enumerate these in one of the chapters in the book, Sloan felt like he had a number of elements that he could draw from to go to court and get a warrant to collect a sample of Jimmy Swingley's DNA. So the second time they went back to the Wabash Correctional Facility, which is on the other side of the state, it's near the Illinois state line. They went in 2018 and were able and basically laid it out for him and said, we've got a court order. We can get a sample of your DNA. And he not only cooperated and gave him a sample of his DNA, but sat down with him for a little while, 45 minutes or something like that, and talked to them and denied that he had anything to do with it at all. As a matter of fact, I'm sure that there were a number of avenues that he raised with them, but came away saying, I've always heard about that, but I've heard it was her stepfather. So while they had a DNA sample of the person who ultimately, and probably even really by that point, but ultimately became the focus of their investigation and was certainly their best person of interest. While they had a DNA sample, they did not have any kind of remorseful confession or anything like that. It was just pretty much kind of what they expected and not that different from their first encounter, except that it was a lot more cordial.
Where were they trying to extract the DNA sample from? What piece of evidence were they? It was that they feel was their best bet for a DNA sample?
Well, and I mentioned it earlier, but one of the very, very few pieces of physical evidence in this case was the gun holster that was partially under Ethan's leg, between his leg and the car seat, that night when they were found. And at the time, that had caused a lot of consternation, because that and the knife that was found on the dashboard of the car kind of led some people to think, well, you know, Ethan came there armed. He must have been expecting something. And, you know, maybe you would go to a park and you would have some way to defend yourself if you're going to be there at almost midnight. I mean, maybe I would. I'd probably just stay home and not be in a park at midnight. But so the knife and then the holster were, over the years, a focus on the part of investigators. The holster so much so because while the knife might have been something that people believed that Ethan owned, the holster was not. He was never known to have a gun, or certainly have a gun that would have a holster on it. So the kind of the theory was that whoever had shot the two teenagers had pulled a gun off his belt. The holster came with it. He shot through the car window, and at some point the holster fell off. And when Ethan slumped or recoiled or something like that, that the holster where it had fallen off kind of partially went under him a little bit, so that it certainly was not something that the shooter could just casually in a dark car in a dark park, after you just fired a gun, not something you would casually reach in and retrieve. So while there's certainly been strides in evidence and DNA matching and DNA cultivation, for that matter, since 1985, they were hoping that by getting this DNA sample of James Jimmy Swingling, they'd be able to match it to something from the holster. And they were not able to do that. That was very frustrating for them, obviously, because they had some element of high hopes. Obviously, they wouldn't have gotten a warrant from a judge to get the DNA sample if they hadn't hoped that something might come of it. But probably because of, by that point, 34 years, 33 years of deterioration of a leather holster. And, you know, I don't have any reason to think there was any kind of bad handling of it or anything like that by police. No. But certainly things do happen and they break down and they become less certain. And it was not the conclusive link that they had hoped.
There was talk of, the idea that there was a drug deal, and Ethan was, by various witnesses and through the rumor mill and again, various witnesses, attested that Ethan was involved, could have been involved in some marijuana deal or some drug deal gone bad. What we didn't mention is the coroner's autopsy reports indicating any kind of drug use from these two people. What were those results?
There was no indication of any kind of drugs in their system, of Ethan and Kimberly. And Marvin Campbell noted in our 2019 interview that we asked their friends and authorities at the time, which no doubt included people from the school and maybe from their churches, the idea that, do you think either one of these kids had any kind of drug use? And Campbell said in 2019, no, we never found anybody who was willing to say that. So, that didn't especially lend credence to the idea that they were there for some purpose. Sorry about that.
The idea, though, too, that the depiction by newspapers was that that this was a lover's lane murder, and not to throw any blame towards these two teenagers, but that's, you say that that was the way they depicted the murders itself, that it was a lover's lane murder. As well, despite these newspaper depictions, what was Nathan Sloan's theory based on all those rumors and all those witness reports, whether some of them were accurate or not? What was his theory, his fundamental theory on what had happened that night to Ethan and Kimberly, and why?
You know, I don't know if he ever verbalized to me or publicly, I'm sure he has not publicly, about exactly what happened that night. But I do think that the elements that were kind of a standard belief from the time really persisted and have for 35 years. And that the idea that teenagers were there for no particular reason other than it was a good place to go. They may not have had any untoward kind of personal activity planned or anything like that, lover's lane kind of suppositions or not. And, you know, one of their friends that we talked to for the book said, there were times when I liked being on a nice night in late summer. I liked just being out somewhere and being in my car, looking at the stars and thinking about things. And God knows any of us, even today, but certainly when we were teenagers, we would spend a lot of time in our own heads. So I think the supposition was and still is that they were there for no untoward or inappropriate reasons other than it was a quiet place. They could spend a little time together. They could just kind of exist, hopefully, quietly and peacefully. Horribly, that did not happen. But there was never anybody who really suggested that there was a concrete thing linking them to the person who killed them, that they were there for some kind of a drug deal, that the person who killed them was there because they knew them. Like you said, many of the things they very quickly were able to eliminate, like, you know, that it was some kind of weird Dungeons and Dragons rivalry gone bad, that it was some kind of a crosstown rivalry between Northside students, which Ethan and Kimberly were, and Southside students. I think eventually all that kind of faded away. Now, whether whoever killed them was there in proximity to them, and that was just total happenstance, I mean, really, I don't know if anybody can say, because certainly the one of the things that over the years was, I think, the most frightening and the most unsettling to people was the idea that there was no reason for it to happen. At the same time, we can kind of comfort ourselves sometime by saying that there wasn't a reason behind this. There wasn't anybody who could be blamed for it except for the killer. There's also this very unsettling element of the idea that someone wandered through in their proximity and did this horrible crime and wandered out. And over the years, I talked to a lot of investigators, and Douglas Walker did also talk to a lot of investigators who were afraid that it would never be solved, that somebody did this and they left town, and maybe they were in, you know, Winslow, Arizona, or Texarkana, Texas, or something, and they went to prison for something else, or they got into a bar fight and they were killed, and the mystery would never be solved. The only possibly other most unsettling theory there is that it was someone who continued to live in the community with people and never was punished. It was never outed. And I think that kind of, those kind of scenarios and how uncertain and unsettling those are is what's kept this in the public eye and what certainly has driven investigators over the decades.
You write that Nathan Sloan found a lot of stuff that seemed to stack up, incriminating and coincidental and circumstantial evidence. Sloan, you write, had found that Swingley's girlfriend in September 85 lived 1,300 feet away from where the bodies were found. He also said that Swingley had told a friend he was afraid that he'd be contacted regarding the murder. In August 86, and we should discuss this, he was pulled over after he came back. After he had left for Florida, he came back. He was pulled over police and gave his name as Kevin Dixon. What do you make about this, pulled over by police, but giving his name as a brother or giving the same last name as the victim of this crime that he knows that he's a suspect for? What do you make of that?
That's one of the things that and I never knew that until 2019. That's one of the things that just is baffling, because it makes you wonder, was that a slip of the tongue? Was that an inadvertent thing? I mean, certainly there are plenty of times where people who are known for some kind of criminal activity, even if it's routine, they don't want to attract the attention of police in the first place, but if they do by some random and minor thing as running a stop sign, you know, they certainly don't want to have their ID on them, so that kind of, you know, sets off alarm bells with police. So it's not unheard of for someone to say a false name when asked who they are if they don't have a license and registration with them that would otherwise tip the officer off.
Sure.
Why that came out of his mouth, I just can't imagine. And I don't know that anybody can answer that except possibly for Jimmy Swingley himself.
If I didn't know any better, it would be. And I don't, there is no evidence in this book. You don't provide it. Obviously, there's not much from him personally, but to give the name as Kevin Dixon in light of everything that had happened and that he knew had happened and that he was, again, a suspect, he knew that he was some sort of suspect by that time. For him to say that is very much like the phone call to Nancy, Kim's mother, in taunting. Yeah. And saying, listen, you know, your daughter was in the wrong place at the wrong time, but Ethan had it coming to him. And that can be not interpreted as informative or helpful. It can really only be deemed as taunting. And this Kevin Dixon seems to be, when he mentions that person's, I don't know if there is a Kevin Dixon, but it seems to be in the same vein, I think, of taunting police.
But, you know, I don't think there is an actual Kevin Dixon. And it seemed so at the time, of course, you know, the officer who pulled him over, it didn't, well, I don't know this for a fact, but it didn't seem to click with him, even though it was only a matter of months. But you know, it's so strange. It's just another odd element of this in that, you know, what would prompt him to say it? Did he do it almost subconsciously? Did he do it as some kind of a taunt? It's just strange and inexplicable, like a lot of elements of this case are.
You also talk about a person named Al Hurst. What does he have to say? And again, what would be his motivation for making up this story?
You know, one of the things about almost any kind of group of people who are kind of on the fringe of, if they're not involved in any kind of criminal activity themselves, maybe they are on the fringe of criminal activity. So you assume that many people who just kind of sit around and shoot the breeze, and they BS about things that they don't really know anything about. You assume that a lot of it is just exactly that, BSing. And a lot of it is really I kind of want to get this out there. I want to tell people about this experience. So when police were talking to people, and Al Hirst had passed away before the bulk of this latter-day investigation took place, but when Hirst was talking to people, those people then later told authorities that on the night of the killings, that Al Hirst had been told by Jimmy Swingley, "You don't want to mess with me. I've already killed two people tonight." And he pulled out a gun and held it to Hirst's head and said, "You know, I'll blow your brains out. You do not want to mess with me." And Hirst told people that. Later, apparently, investigators, including Nate Sloan, talked to those people, and they were understandably, since a lot of time had passed, they're understandably pretty hazy about how they'd heard that and whether they ever heard that, or even for that matter, how well Al Hirst knew Jimmy Swingley. But certainly another one of those, you know, is that a tell? Is that a self-implication? Is it just bragging? Is it BSing on the part of any number of people who are involved in this scenario? It's hard to tell. And that's, of course, one of the things that police investigators are constantly weighing, how much emphasis they should place on something that is told to them. In this case, there was enough that when Nate Sloan asked for a DNA warrant, that was among the things he cited. So he was fairly convinced that it was a telling recounting of an incident.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, with this, Nathan Sloan, he thinks he has an opportunity with the DNA, but it's not a match. Like you had mentioned, the holster itself, the DNA that was present there, been deteriorated significantly enough that there was no match able to be had with Swingley, and so no more conviction. Now, he resides with a 65-year sentence, but as you write in the conclusion of this book, that doesn't mean he'll spend the rest of his life in prison. When is he scheduled to be released?
Right now, according to the Indiana Department of Correction, he's due to be released in 2030. So about, it'd be 9 years from now, I think this spring sometime, 9 years from then. And I mean, he's certainly done a number of things to try to get a sentence mitigated or lessened. He's not been successful in doing that with a judge in the case. It's not the judge who sentenced him. It's that judge's successor on the bench of Delaware Circuit Court. And he's done things that certainly better himself, you know, various kinds of studies and programs and courses and things that he's gone through. He's also done things that certainly you want to, if you're an inmate, you want to have on your record as far as saying, you know, I'm working toward rehabilitation. I'm not the same person I was in 1996 when this friend of my friend's was killed. And you know, certainly I imagine that any time an inmate goes to a judge and says, "Would you consider some kind of leniency, whether it's a change in my status in the system or earlier release or anything like that?" So far, that has not worked for him. And right now, the year 2030 is when he is supposed to be released.
And he'll be, I think you're right that he'd be about 67 years old, so not entirely. Many years left in his life anyway, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah, there is, one of the things about this is that I know that after 35 years ago, I seemed young. You seemed young, but the case is that this occurred at a time when all of these players were so young, and by their own hand, or in the case of Ethan and Kimberly, certainly not by their own hand, their lives were just disrupted, shattered, ended at such a young age, and it's startling and tragic.
Yeah. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about the West Side Park murders, Muncie's most notorious cold case. This is a Arcadia Publishing and History Press release. Tell us about how they might find out more information. Do you have a website? Tell us about that, please.
If you go to the website for History Press, you can do a search for the book. It just came out February 8th.
Great.
And the reaction to it seems to be pretty good. I base that mostly on comments that I'm getting, but also the fact that Amazon was selling it. All of our books are available on Amazon for people who are okay with online book selling as opposed to a local bookstore. But Amazon, it was out of stock for a few days, and they've only just recently gotten it back in stock. So apparently there was a little more demand than maybe was expected by either History Press or Amazon, but it's available there, Amazon or History Press's website. And, a friend of mine, my sister-in-law, bought it from Barnes & Noble online, which still exists. So you can certainly find it out there if you'd like.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Keith Roysden. It's been a pleasure. The West Side Park Murders, Muncie's Most Notorious Cold Case. Thank you so much. You have a great evening. Thank you so much. Good night.
Thank you. Good night.